Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 747, titled Bringing It All Back Home. This program is being recorded on June 26th of the year 2011. This program is going to consist largely of reading and analysis of a very important article authored by Robert Perry of the Consortium News. I've interviewed Robert Perry in the past and also used his articles. He is the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege About the Bush Family. And he's written a very good article in which he talks about the Republican political playbook, the Republican political agenda, and he compares it accurately, in my opinion, to the basic MO that is used by the Central Intelligence Agency and other intelligence services to destabilize targeted countries on behalf of the corporate and economic interests that stand to benefit from such a destabilization. I want to stress that Robert Perry himself, I think, is overly credulous about the lack of application of methodology such as deadly force, specifically assassination and other means of bloodletting, as a vehicle for furthering this domestic destabilization. Perry has written, for example, about the October surprise in the past, the destabilization of the Carter administration through the manipulation of the Iranian hostage situation in 1979-80. However, Perry generally steers clear of things like this country's political assassinations, not only the big ones of the 60s, but also very clear indications that the bloodletting has continued apace. Nonetheless, despite this deficiency in not only this article but also in Perry's general perspective, I think he's done a very good job here of framing the Republican political agenda for America and for the Obama administration as basically the manifestation of a covert operation, as the manifestation of a program, a blueprint for destabilization and subversion. Except that the country that is targeted for destabilization and subversion here is the United States. And what Perry has done is to construct what I think is generally a valid comparison between the USA and Chile under Salvador Allende. This particular article was posted by the Consortium News on June 9th of 2011. It has been carried on among other websites, the Alternet website. And I'm going to read this article right now. Modern Republicans have a simple approach to politics when they're not in the White House. Make America as ungovernable as possible by using almost any means available, from challenging the legitimacy of opponents to spreading lies and disinformation to sabotaging the economy. Over the past four decades or so, the Republicans have simply not played by the old give-and-take rules of politics. Indeed, if one were to step back and assess this Republican approach, what you would see is something akin to how the CIA has destabilized target countries, especially those that seek to organize themselves in defiance of capitalist orthodoxy. To stop this spread of, quote, socialism, unquote, nearly anything goes. Take, for example, Chile in the early 1970s, when socialist President Salvador Allende won an election and took steps aimed at improving the conditions of the country's poor. Under the direction of President Richard Nixon and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, the CIA was dispatched to engage in psychological warfare against Allende's government and to make the Chilean economy scream, unquote. U.S. intelligence agencies secretly sponsored Chilean news outlets like the influential newspaper El Mercurio and supported populist, unquote, uprisings of truckers and housewives. On the economic front, the CIA coordinated efforts to starve the Chilean government of funds and to drive unemployment higher. Worsening joblessness could then be spun by the CIA-financed news outlets as proof that Allende's policies didn't work and that the only choice for Chile was to scrap its social programs. When Allende compromised with the right, that had the additional benefit of causing friction between him and some of his supporters who wanted even more radical change. I think something somewhat similar is taking place with Obama as well. Continuing. As Chile became increasingly ungovernable, the stage was set for the violent overthrow of Allende, the installation of a rightist dictatorship, and the imposition of free market economics that directed more wealth and more power to Chile's rich and their American corporate backers. Though the Allende case in Chile is perhaps the best-known example of this intelligence strategy, because it was investigated by a Senate committee in the mid-1970s, the CIA has employed this approach frequently around the world. Sometimes the target government is removed without violence, although other times a bloody coup d'etat has been part of the mix. So it is perhaps fitting that a comparable approach to politics would eventually come home to roost in the United States, even to the point that some of the propaganda funding comes from outside sources. Think of Reverend Sun Myung-moon's Washington Times and Australian media mogul Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, for example. Obviously, given the wealth of the American elites, the relative proportion of the propaganda funding is derived more domestically in the United States than it would be in a place like Chile or some other unfortunate third world country that has gotten on Washington's bad side. But the concept remains the same. Control as much as possible what the population gets to see and hear, create chaos for your opponent's government economically and politically, blame it for the mess, and establish in the minds of the voters that their only way out is to submit and that the pain will stop once your side is back in power. Today's Republicans have fully embraced this concept of political warfare, whereas the Democrats generally have tried to play by the old rules, acquiescing when Republicans are in office with the goal of making government work, unquote, even if the Republicans are setting the agenda. Unlike the Democrats and the left, the Republicans and the right have prepared themselves for this battle almost as if they are following a CIA training manual. They have invested tens of billions of dollars in a propaganda infrastructure that operates 24/7, year-round, to spot and exploit missteps by political enemies. This vertically integrated media machine allows useful information to move quickly from a right-wing blog to talk radio to Fox News to the Wall Street Journal to conservative magazines and book publishing. Right-wing propagandists are well-trained and well-funded, so they can be deployed to all manner of public outlets to hammer home the talking points. When a Democrat somehow does manage to get into the White House, Republicans in Congress and even in the courts are ready to do their part in the destabilization campaign. Rather than grant traditional honeymoon periods of cooperation with the president's early policies, the battle lines are drawn immediately. In late 1992, for instance, Bill Clinton complained that his honeymoon, unquote, didn't even last through the transition, the two-plus months before a new president takes office. He found himself facing especially harsh hazing from the Washington Press Corps as the mainstream media, seeking to shed its liberal label and goaded by the right-wing media, tried to demonstrate that it would be tougher on a Democrat than it would be on any Republican. The mainstream press hyped minor scandals about Clinton's Whitewater real estate investment and Travelgate, a flap about some routine firings at the White House travel office. Meanwhile, the right's rapidly growing media was spreading false stories implicating Clinton in the death of White House aide Vince Foster and other, quote, mysterious deaths, unquote. Republicans in Congress did all they could to feed the press hysteria, holding hearings and demanding that special prosecutors be appointed. When the Clinton administration relented, the choice of prosecutors was handed over to right-wing Republican appeals court judge David Sentell, who consciously picked political enemies of Clinton to oversee zealous investigations. The use of scandal-mongering to destabilize the Clinton administration finally peaked in late 1998 and 99, when the Republican-controlled House voted impeachment and Clinton had to endure but survive a humiliating trial in the Senate. The Republican strategy, however, continued into campaign 2000, with Vice President Al Gore facing attacks on both his character and his integrity. Gore was falsely painted as a delusional braggart, as both right-wing and mainstream media outlets freely misquoted him and subjected him to ridicule while simultaneously bowing and scraping before Republican candidate George W. Bush. When Gore managed to win the national popular vote anyway, and would have carried the key state of Florida if all legally cast ballots had been counted, the Republicans and the right rose up in fury, demanding that the Florida count be stopped before Bush's tiny lead completely disappeared. Starting a minor riot in Miami, the Republicans showed how far they would go to claim the White House once again. Five Republican partisans on the U.S. Supreme Court, waiting to ensure that the new president would keep their side in control of the courts, and recognizing that their party was prepared to spread disorder if Gore prevailed, stopped the counting of votes and made Bush the winner, unquote. Despite this partisan ruling, Gore and the Democrats stepped back from the political confrontation. The right-wing press cheered and gloated while the mainstream news media urged the people to accept Bush as, quote, legitimate, unquote, for the good of the country. For most of Bush's disastrous presidency, this dynamic remained the same. Though barely able to complete a coherent sentence, Bush was treated with great deference even when he failed to protect the country from the 9/11 attacks and led the nation into an unprovoked war with Iraq. There were no combative investigations of Bush like those that surrounded Clinton. Even at the end of Bush's presidency, when his policies of deregulation, tax cuts for the rich, and massive budget deficits combined to create the biggest financial crisis since the Great Depression, the prevailing message from the establishment was that it was unfair to lay too much blame on Bush. Shortly after Barack Obama took office in 2009, a Republican right-wing talking point was to complain that when anyone took note of the mess that Bush had left behind, quote, there you go again, blaming Bush, unquote. Immediately, too, the Republicans and the right set to work both demonizing and destroying Obama's presidency instead of allowing the Democrats to enact legislation aimed at addressing the financial and economic crisis that Bush had caused, the Senate Republicans launched filibuster after filibuster. When Obama and the Democrats did push through emergency legislation such as the $787 billion stimulus package, they had to water it down to reach the 60-vote supermajority needed to overcome a filibuster. The Republicans and the right then quickly laid the blame for high unemployment on the failed, unquote, stimulus. There were also waves of propaganda pounding Obama's personal legitimacy. The right's news media pressed bogus accusations that Obama had been born in Kenya and thus was not constitutionally eligible to be president. He was denounced as a socialist, a Muslim, a fascist, an enemy of Israel, and pretty much any other charge that might hit some American hot button. When Obama welcomed American students back to school in 2009, the right organized against his simple message, urging young people to work hard as if it were some form of totalitarian mind control. His attempt to address the growing crisis in American health care was denounced as taking away freedoms and imposing, quote, death panels, unquote. Soon, billionaires like oil man David Koch and media mogul Murdoch were promoting a grassroots, unquote, rebellion against Obama called the Tea Party. Activists were showing up at presidential speeches with guns and brandishing weapons at rallies near Washington. The high decibel disruptions and the screaming economy created the impression of political chaos. Largely ignoring the role of the Republicans in causing it, the press faulted Obama for failing to live up to his campaign promise to bring a greater bipartisanship to Washington. Hearing the discord framed that way, many average Americans also blamed Obama. Many of the president's supporters grew demoralized, and, as happened with Allende in Chile, some on the left turned against Obama for not doing more faster. By November of 2010, the stage was set for a big Republican comeback. The party swept to victory in the House and fell just short in the Senate. But Congress was not the Republicans' true goal. What they really want is the White House with all its executive powers. However, following Obama's success in killing Osama bin Laden on May 2nd, and with what is widely regarded as a weak Republican presidential field, the right's best hope for regaining complete control of the U.S. government in 2012 is to sink the U.S. economy. Already, the Republican success in limiting the scope of the stimulus package and then labeling it as a failure, combined with deep cuts in local, state, and federal government spending, have helped push the economy back to the brink where a double-dip recession is now a serious concern. By the way, this is not unlike what the austerity program is doing to Greece and possibly may do to other EU economies, there at the behest of Germany, here at the behest of the Republican right wing. Continuing, despite these worries and a warning from Moody's about a possible downgrade on U.S. debt if Congress delays action on raising the debt limit, the Republicans are vowing more brinksmanship over the debt limit vote. Before acting, they are demanding major reductions in government spending while refusing to raise taxes on the rich. So Obama and the Democrats face another conundrum. If they slash spending too much, they will further stall the recovery. However, if they refuse to submit to this latest round of Republican blackmail, they risk a debt crisis that could have devastating consequences for the U.S. economy for years, even decades to come. Either way, the right-wing media and much of the mainstream press will put the blame on Obama and the Democrats. They will be held accountable for failing to govern. The Republican propaganda machine will tell the American people that they must throw Obama and the Democrats out of office for stability to return. There will be assurances about how the magic of the market, unquote, will bring back the bright days of prosperity. Of course, the reality of a new Republican administration, especially with a GOP Congress, would be the return of the old right-wing nostrums. More tax cuts for the rich, less regulation of corporations, more military spending, and more privatization of social programs. Any budget balancing will come at the expense of labor rights for union employees and shifting the costs for health care back onto the backs of the elderly. Yet all this will be surrounded by intense propaganda explaining the public pain as a hangover from misguided government, quote, social engineering, unquote. There is, of course, the possibility that the American people will see through today's Republican CIA-style strategy of making the economy scream, unquote. Americans might come to recognize the role of the pseudo-populist propagandists on Fox News and talk radio. Or Republicans might have second thoughts about playing chicken on the debt limit and running the risk of a global depression. Such a gamble could rebound against them, and it's hard to believe that even their most ardent billionaire backers would find destruction of their stock portfolios that appealing. But there can be a momentum to madness. We have seen throughout history that events can get out of hand that thoroughly propagandized true believers can truly believe. Sometimes, they don't understand that they are simply being manipulated for a lesser goal. Once the chaos starts, it's hard to restore order. That has been another bloody lesson from the CIA's operations in countries around the world. These covert actions can have excessive or unintended consequences. Ousting Allende turned Chile into a fascist dictatorship that sent assassins far and wide, including Washington, D.C. Ousting Mossadegh in Iran led to the tyranny of the Shah and ultimately to an extreme Islamist backlash. Ousting Arbenz in Guatemala led to the butchery of some 200,000 people and the rise of a narco-state. Such examples can go on and on. However, these CIA-type techniques can be very seductive, both to U.S. presidents looking for a quick fix to some international problem and to a political party trying to gain a decisive edge for winning. These methods can be especially dangerous when the other side doesn't organize effectively to counter them. The hard reality in the United States today is that the Republicans and the right are now fully organized, armed with a potent propaganda machine and possessing an extraordinary political will to use it. They are well positioned to roll the U.S. economy off the cliff and blame the catastrophe on Obama. Indeed, that may be their best hope for winning election 2012. Again, that comes from Robert Perry. It is a posting in which he basically is comparing the Republican playbook for the U.S. and for the Obama administration with the CIA's playbook for errant third world countries, in this case, a fairly extensive comparison of the destabilization of the Allende regime by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and, of course, CIA with what is taking place today. Again, one of the things to note here is that the methodology and indeed the world of covert operations has indeed come home. One of the strong points of Russ Baker's book, Family of Secrets, and one of the reasons that I went into it at such great length, initially I went into that in For the Record programs 7-11 through 7-16 inclusive, is that that book, some 600 pages or so, details the Bush administration, really the Bush family, excuse me, the Bush family's decades-long involvement with covert operations, inextricably linked in turn with the Bush family's machinations as denizens of the American corporate elite landscape. And indeed, the rise of people like Karl Rove and others in the 1970s took place when George Poppy Bush was rising to power as well. Karl Rove being a protege of George Poppy Bush, for whom CIA headquarters is named. One of the things to understand about this brinksmanship, and one of the things to understand about the very sad and scary things that are taking place with regard to the economy, is that this was deliberately planned. What we're going to do is to jump back in time, and we're going to revisit some articles that I read into the record in For the Record program number 412, The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train. This was done in June of 2003, some 8 years ago. And we're going to revisit a column by Paul Krugman of the New York Times from May 27th of 2003. It's called Stating the Obvious, and it reads in part as follows. The lunatics are now in charge of the asylum. So wrote the normally staid Financial Times, traditionally the voice of solid British business opinion when surveying last week's bill. Indeed, the legislation is doubly absurd. The gimmicks used to make an $800-plus billion tax cut carry an official price tag of only $320 billion are a joke, yet the cost without the gimmicks is so large that the nation can't possibly afford it while keeping its other promises, unquote. But then, maybe that's just the point. The Financial Times suggests that more extreme Republicans, unquote, actually want a fiscal train wreck. Proposing to slash federal spending, particularly on social programs, is a tricky electoral proposition. But a fiscal crisis offers the tantalizing prospect of forcing such cuts through the back door, unquote. Good for the Financial Times. This, of course, is Krugman writing. It seems that stating the obvious has now finally become respectable. It's no secret that right-wing ideologues want to abolish programs Americans take for granted. But not long ago, to suggest that the Bush administration's policies might actually be driven by those ideologues, that the administration was deliberately setting the country up for a fiscal crisis in which popular social programs could be sharply cut, was to be accused of spouting conspiracy theories. Yet, by pushing through another huge tax cut in the face of record deficits, the administration clearly demonstrates that it is completely, either that it is completely feckless, or that it actually wants a fiscal crisis, or maybe both. Here's one way to look at the situation. Although you wouldn't know it from the rhetoric, federal taxes are already historically low as a share of GDP. Once the new round of cuts takes effect, federal taxes will be lower than their average during the Eisenhower administration. How, then, can the government pay for Medicare and Medicaid, which didn't exist in the 1950s, and Social Security, which will become far more expensive as the population ages? Defense spending has fallen compared with the economy, but not that much, and it's on the rise again. The answer is that it can't. The government can borrow to make up the difference as long as investors remain in denial, unable to believe that the world's only superpower is turning into a banana republic. But at some point, bond markets will balk. They won't lend money to a government, even that of the United States, if that government's debt is growing faster than its revenues, and there is no plausible story about how the budget will eventually come under control. At that point, either taxes will go up again, or programs that have become fundamental to the American way of life will be gutted. We can be sure that the right will do whatever it takes to preserve the Bush tax cut. Right now, the administration is even skimping on Homeland Security to save a few dollars here and there. But balancing the books without tax increases will require deep cuts where the money is, that is, in Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security. The pain of these benefit cuts will fall on the middle class and the poor, while the tax cuts overwhelmingly favor the rich. For example, the tax cut passed last week will raise the after-tax income of most people by less than 1%, not nearly enough to compensate them for the loss of benefits. But people with incomes over $1 million per year will, on average, see their after-tax income rise 4.4%. The Financial Times suggests that this is deliberate, and I agree. For them, the Financial Times says of these extreme Republicans, undermining the multilateral international order is not enough. Long-held views on income distribution also require radical revision. How can this be happening? Most people, even most liberals, are complacent. They don't realize how dire the fiscal outlook really is, and they don't read what the ideologues write. They imagine that the Bush administration, like the Reagan administration, will modify our system only at the edges, that it won't destroy the social safety net built up over the past 70 years. But the people now running America aren't conservatives. They are radicals who want to do away with the social and economic system we have, and the fiscal crisis that they are deliberately concocting may give them the excuse that they need. The Financial Times, it seems, now understands what's going on, but when will the public wake up? And indeed, that is a very, very interesting question indeed. We're going to continue with some of the information that we downloaded in For the Record program number 412, The Engineer Intends to Wreck the Train, from June of 2003, almost exactly 8 years ago. However, we have not got time in on this side. We are, however, going to pick up the thread of discussion in side two, because this concludes side one For the Record program number 747, Bringing It All Back Home. This is being recorded on June 26th of the year 2011. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.